Hello and welcome to Onward, the Fundrise podcast, where you can find out more about what's happening at Fundrise and where you'll hear in-depth conversations about the big trends affecting the U.S. and global economies. My name is Ben Miller. I am CEO and co-founder of Fundrise. Before we get started, I want to remind you that this podcast is not investment advice. It is intended for informational and entertainment purposes only. We have a special guest today, Ira Lubert. Ira Lubert is a legendary investor that I can bet you've never heard of, and that's no accident. Although he is a major investor across nearly every private asset class, from real estate to venture capital, he does not seek the limelight. It's actually part of his playbook, which you'll hear on the episode. In fact, if I hadn't worked directly for Ira, I'm sure he wouldn't have done this podcast, but he did me a big favor. Ira is the co-founder of almost a dozen different investment platforms, which together constitute Independence Capital Partners, a nearly $50 billion fund complex. I worked for Ira for a number of years, and so I know he's a powerhouse, a multi-billion dollar investor across more sectors than I can count. He's a world-class investor and my first boss, from whom I learned a lot. So without further ado, Ira Lubert. Ira, welcome to Onward.
Ben, great to see you again.
It's a pleasure. I'm so glad you could be here. So I have a lot of questions for you. One of the main topics I have is that you're a rare investor. In my career, I've never met anyone with such a broad scope of investment areas. So let me just list them out here. Real estate, corporate growth equity in tech and healthcare, life sciences, debt funds, middle market small business finance, hedge funds, hotel management, funds that invest in community banks, and your fair share of venture capital.
You missed a couple.
I couldn't get them all. I knew it.
We founded a bankruptcy fund called Versa, and I own the third or fourth largest municipal tax lien business in America that no one's ever heard about.
And the other thing about it is that in each one of these categories, you are at scale. These are not small investments. You're probably $1 billion per category. And some of the categories is $10 billion. So across it all, I don't know if it's $40, $50 billion, but enormous scale.
Well, the eight funds alone, which is public, the eight fund families that you briefly discussed is today $47 billion under management, which is three real estate funds and private equity venture and life science and bankruptcy and dedicated banking. That's the $47 billion. And then there's the family office that does the other things you mentioned, like the hedge funds, the tax liens, the management companies, et cetera.
So as you imagine, I have a lot of questions. Another thing I heard you say is you personally have over 100 partners.
Yeah, I believe since inception, it's been over 100. Probably today, it's 60 or 70 active partners.
The thing about you, because I used to work for you, so I know this, is that I'm sure at one point or another, you've been actively involved, like in the work of every one of these areas.
Yeah, but I think it's worth stepping back a little bit to understand the concept and the structure. I truly get tremendous gratification out of partnering with entrepreneurs, many of whom take far more risk than I ever took at their age. So calling myself an entrepreneur when I was in my 30s was, frankly, an exaggeration. I wasn't an entrepreneur back then. I had a corporate job and I was investing in real estate and operating businesses on the side. And I only became an entrepreneur when I had enough income from those outside investments to leave corporate America at age 47, I might add. I have so much respect for entrepreneurs like yourself that put everything on the line and go for it. And I found over the last 30 years of doing this that not only the gratification, but really and truly through the success of these partners comes my success. I found early in my career, Ben, that there are certain aspects that I do well and certain aspects of things in business I don't do well or I do very poorly. And I did a self-assessment in my 30s, and that's how I structured my business. I realized it, and I think most people don't come to this realization, but your basic personality is your personality. You're not going to change. You might be on good behavior. You might try to make changes. But I'm an impatient person, a terrible manager of people. And over time, I realized that's not going to change. I wanted to structure a concept that was a concept that benefited other investors or other partners and benefited me. And that's what you see in front of you today, a culmination of that.
So, okay, let me ask a bunch of follow-up questions from that, because there's like deep insight in the conclusion you came to. Usually having that type of insight is unusual. Part of that, I feel like I tell the team here, knowing what you're bad at and admitting it is a strength. It doesn't make you look worse. It makes you look better. Most people are afraid to own things that they look dumb. They feel incompetent. I do it every day. One set of questions I have for you, what's the advantage of being such a broad-based investor?
There are many. There are certainly many. One is we're very opportunistic. And again, it plays to strengths and weaknesses. I really believe that my structure resonates with a meaningful amount of people. So if you allow me, let me give you an example in the private equity world. So every successful company, let's just suggest there's a 50-something-year-old founder, man or woman, and at some point they want to take X dollars off the table. And they call up a banker or go directly to private equity funds to try to sell a piece of their business. And the example I use is the 32-year-old Wharton or Stanford MBA walks in representing even my fund, LLR, or 20 others. And after 10 minutes, this 31-year-old brilliant MBA says, we want to own as much as you'll sell us of your company, as long as it's at least 51%. And in essence, we get total control. I follow those folks into that meeting in the next meeting, and I say to that entrepreneur, you know, I just saw Joe Blow walk out the door. I happen to know his firm well. I don't know him quite as well, but by reputation, I know he's extremely bright. So let me guess, he wants to buy 51% up to 100% of your company. And I guess my question would be is, why do you want to be managed by a 31-year-old Stanford MBA? When you've started and built this business or took it over from your dad and built it into a meaningful business, I want to buy a meaningful but minority piece of your company. I define that as 20 to 40%. But by the way, I can't pay you the same value that Joe Blow's paying you because he's getting what's called a majority premium. I have to get a minority discount because you're going to be in control. And by the way, once we make this investment, there's only three things you can't do, only three. And you can't take on major debt without my approval. By the way, you can sell it tomorrow as long as you tag me along at the same terms, not the same value, the same terms, because I own less than you. And by the way, Joe, I believe that if we go in together and we keep it for 7 years, and at 64, you decide you really want to sell everything, which is your decision, not mine, that when you sell it, the fact that you own 60% instead of 30%, you're going to end up cashing out far better than if you had taken a majority sale today. That's a contrarian approach. I use it in all my investments. You were close to it at Lubert Adler. I mean, you know my partner well. He owns more of Lubert Adler than I do. So when we started Lubert Adler, Dean and I were equal partners with the agreement that as I built out Independence Capital, his ownership went up, mine went down. As we grew the business, we needed to give more ownership to others. It came from me. So how many times in life do you hear that a partner's willing to give up ownership as successful growth is there? And I'd rather own a much smaller piece of a bigger pie because the partners are working 24/7 growing the business. And this is the key concept. Through their success comes my success. They're so engulfed in their business, they don't have time to do other businesses. But if I have 70 of those guys and 50 of them are great and 20 are just short of being great and maybe some are average, the collective nature of that model has been phenomenal for me. And I don't need to be reading about myself in the paper. I don't need the publicity. I want that to be my partners. And I conclude by saying, I've always said this, I know I have a good partnership. When my partners go to cocktail parties and someone asks them what they do, I want them to say, I'm the founder of the ABC fund or the XYZ company. They might say Ira Lubert's an investor or a partner, but they want the recognition of what they started, built, and enhanced. And they don't want it to be Ira Lubert. And knowing all that, taking a contrarian approach has enabled me to build a model and a business. And by the way, I'm not saying it's better or worse or good or bad. My model is my model. I've not seen it replicated. Maybe it has been. I've just never run across anyone doing it to the extent I have. 270 plus minus investments, 99% are minority. I have one or two where I own majority. I've just not seen the model. And I've often wondered, what if I started a checkered paint company and all I did was start that company and grow it myself? Where would I be today? I'd like to believe I'd be able to do it, but I know with the weaknesses that I talked about earlier, I think it would have imploded because I would have lost key people. I wouldn't have had the patience to work through the problems. People that didn't have my work ethic and worked as hard as me, I would have been not happy about and might have caused some cultural damages to the company. So I've chosen this path. It's matured. It's a marathon. It takes years to develop. Today, it's a mature path that pays daily dividends to me. That's kind of the path I've taken. And again, I don't in any way represent that it's the best path out there. There's multiple paths to success. I mean, everybody says their business is unique and different. That's total crap. The vast majority of all businesses operate the same way. But my path to investing, I'm not saying it's unique. I just haven't been able to find anyone else who's taken it to the level I have.
The natural follow-up question is why? Why haven't others done that? It doesn't seem that unusual from a theoretical point of view, but I agree with you. It's not private equity's playbook. What's the reason?
I think it comes down to one thing. And I think that most people lack confidence and need control. I think the vast majority of entrepreneurs are very hesitant to give up control in any avenue of business. And if you just think about someone walking in and the first thing out of their mouth is, you don't give up control.
Everyone should be doing it, but only you or a few people are doing it. Most people are not doing that. So why aren't other private equity funds pursuing that model?
Well, I'm a family office that does it. Private equity funds have a fiduciary obligation to their investors, and they feel by having control, it's a lot easier path to implement their plans. I also believe that private equity funds, and they should feel this way, that they know better than the entrepreneur and how to grow the company. In my case, I just want to tweak how the entrepreneur grows their business. I think I have certain attributes or life's experiences that can help them. They have far more knowledge of the business than I'm ever going to have, or the real estate. Candidly, I learned from them on occasion. I just think it's a combination of those things. And by the way, keep in mind, my approach takes a long time. As I said earlier, it's a marathon. Owning 20 to 40% of a lot of things takes time to get the scale versus a private equity fund that's got to get to a end of a life cycle and give their capital back. You know, they invest over 4 years, they harvest over three more, and they monetize over the last three, and they have to sell. Where in my family office, we don't have to sell. Keep in mind, in my eight fund families, that $47 billion that we talked about, I've completely delegated to partners like Dean, and they do it their way, meaning they do what the other private equity funds do. But I get a minority piece of each of those funds rolled up into my family office to deploy that capital.
They need control so they can sell, most of all. I also think to some extent they're selling their expertise, and so they need to be able to apply it. You said something about what it teaches you, and I was interested to understand sort of what investing across all these sectors teaches you, and what patterns do you see that others don't see? Sort of what insights do you get?
Well, one, I think I've learned a lot about characteristics of people, and I've tried to refine that over the 40 plus years I've been doing this. I haven't always got it right, but I've got it right far more times than wrong. So I look for what I call best of breed people. And those people have to have a ton of qualities, but they have to have these four. I call them jacks or better. They have to be honest, ethical. They're not the same thing. Committed and capable. So through the dialogues prior to due diligence, getting to know the, if you will, the partner, entrepreneur that owns the business or the real estate, I want to explore that individual having a high degree of those four characteristics. If they do, I look further for other characteristics. And then the deal can be an average deal as long as I have a best of breed partner. Because I learned a long time ago, I've made mistakes when I've taken great deals or great technology with average people versus average technology with great people. Great people will always find a way to win. That's who I want to back.
You talked about your weaknesses. You didn't talk about your strengths. So what are the strengths you think that make your formula or this or the idea of being a partner to entrepreneurs work?
Well, one, I think I can read a room very quickly about the aspects of the partner. I'm good at raising capital, as I think you know. And I think that's a weakness of most entrepreneurs. So I take that burden off their shoulders, which in what I call reading the room, when I sit across from someone, I always try to figure out in my mind, what is it that they need? I want to concentrate on the potential partner's needs. And a lot of them won't come right out and say, you know what, I hate raising capital, I'm bad at it, or I need some connections or relationships. So through our questionings and getting to know each other, I want to try to figure out what it is they need and would like. And then I try to structure in those areas, and I try to do a self-evaluation to see, can I truly fulfill those needs? A basic one typically always is the need to raise capital. Most people, they just don't enjoy doing it. As a result, they don't do it well, and they're hesitant to do it. As you know, the eight fund families I run, my partners in each one were great operators, but none of them ever had experience raising capital, nor wanted to raise capital. So it allowed me to come in as a partner to start these funds. Second, I really think that I can make quicker decisions than most people in our business. Not that I'm always right, but I know the characteristics we look for. Third, and probably the most important, I'll always negotiate a very, what I call wholesale deal. I don't buy at retail. I'm really rarely ever the highest price offer. I'm usually the lowest price offer. But one of the attributes that I think is very important, that once I shake someone's hands, forget what the legal papers say. Once I shake their hands, I'll never retrade them. On occasion, after due diligence, I'll go back and say, look, your company's not worth what we agreed to based on due diligence, but I'm not investing. I'm never going to come back and say, I'll do it if you lower the price. I just think that's reputational damage. So to me, understanding the deal and then honoring that deal is extremely important because you build your business based on prior experiences with people you've partnered with. And we welcome telling people, go call these 9 people or 2 people or 10 people, whatever you want to do. And have we been what I call a value-added partner versus just cash? Have we helped you grow your business? Have we added value? And were we honorable to deal with? And if you had to do it over again, the key question is, would you do it again? And that's, I think, the strengths we bring to the party, or I bring to the party.
You actually teed me up for my next category of questions I'm interested in. I started Fundrise. A lot of my view and sort of mission around Fundrise was about how capital is raised. If you run an operating business, you don't raise capital more than maybe once every few years. It's not what you do. So of course, you're not the best at it. And you don't have the network. You don't have this group likes XYZ this year. That group likes something else. It's a capability that most people don't know about. Really, there's a system. And the system's different depending on what kind of institution you're talking about. So I'm really interested in sort of digging a little bit deeper into that. So as an open-ended question, how would you describe the system? How would you describe the type of investors and how to approach them, what matters to them?
To start, I think the options today are far greater than they were when I started. I think technology has enabled companies like yours with someone who has a brilliant idea. But even your idea wouldn't have worked without enhanced technology that wasn't available when I started raising capital. And kudos to you to understand what that technology could do for you in opening up a market where there's a tremendous need and desire that wasn't available to someone like me 30 years ago because the technology didn't exist. We do 3 forms of raising capital. Institutional family office endowment is one I call major category, which is where most of our capital comes from. 2 would be RIAs, where you go to a third-party wealth manager. A lot of people have their hands out as part of the fees to raise that capital, which We don't do that. So I go direct. And then third is high net worth individuals, which is more analogous to what you do, where, you know, you build a relationship of credibility and sustained hopeful success where you get repeat business there. Each message is a little different to the three groups, but we've been successful across those three areas. Again, it all resonates back to respect for capital of your investors' money. My entire life, I've always put my investors' capital in front of my own capital. Even if it's short-term pain for me, it's been long-term success for me in doing that. And I think some people, unfortunately, don't focus on that aspect of it. They don't respect the investors' capital as much as they should. I think there's some Wall Street examples of that in prior years as well that you and I could come up with if we had enough time.
So actually, I remember you saying this, this is a long time ago. You wish that you could be the allocator across your funds. Normally, you have to raise the money, talking institutional money here. You're raising the money fund by fund. But when you actually are closer to a lot of the execution, you'd allocate, you have to take a different approach. That was 20 years ago when you said that.
I truly believe that when I said it, I thought I was right, and I couldn't believe more that I was right. And I'll tell you why. Markets change. Just look at today's market with the unavailability of debt right now. But if I have a core plus fund today and I can't get a mortgage, I'm taking committed capital fees from my investors to go buy a core plus asset that I can't get a market rate mortgage on. That's one maybe bad example, but it's an example. If people entrusted their capital to me and said, investing is cycle oriented, and I trust that you've invested over multiple asset classes, and I'm going to entrust my capital to you because I realize investing is cycle driven and opportunistically based. Those are two key parts. And you look for the cycle where the best opportunities are. Some might have a longer cycle or longer period of time before we monetize. Others have less. But as you know, Ben, you can't check a box at a pension fund, a union pension fund, a college endowment. The money's allocated going in, not on an opportunistic basis. So I just think the people that need to check the box and approve something, it's just too difficult to get it approved. It's not an easy yes for our customer base.
Yeah. I mean, in both this instance and the earlier one, an insight I think I had from my experience was that the structure often dictates the behavior. So a closed-ended fund means they want control because they have to sell, or you raise institutional money and they have structures and forces you into these narrow paths. And if you want to change paths, even if it's better, makes more sense, you're not paid to, you're paid to do this thing. And then the big downside is how many funds have I seen that are raised that don't put the money out? They're doing XYZ strategy. They raise the money. It's committed. They're going to put that money out hell or high water.
And by the way, it gets compounded, Ben, because if it's your first fund and you put it out just to put it out to raise the second fund, you're never going to have anyone understand how well or bad you did in fund one until a year or two after fund two. So you've got a double fund paying double fees to the GPs. And then their hope is they'll get it right in the second fund and kind of forget about the first fund performance when they go out for fund three, if they can go out for fund three based on how well they did in fund two. And then back to the other obstacle in getting an opportunistic situation, every one of these funds, these pension funds, have allocation metrics. How would they ever have something that might, God forbid, be 2% over their allocation metrics if somebody's, some consultant working for the state of who knows, said you should only have 9% of this and 7% of that and 22% of this. It's all crap. It really is crap. You need diversification, but it doesn't mean you can't have diversification in similar asset classes. It's still diversification. And there's so many ways you get diversification, geographically, product type, et cetera, et cetera.
You've gotten right to the sweet spot of the area I'm interested in. You said two really interesting things. Let me go back to the first one, because you're talking about how the fund structure drives the sort of sometimes bizarre behavior. So for example, in 2021, venture, all this money was raised, I think most money raised in history, and it was invested at the sort of crazy prices. So So why did they do that? If you want to be kind about it, basically the institutional investor allocated money to them and hired them to do a job, which was to invest into that allocation. And they don't have any other choice but to invest into that allocation. And if they don't do it, they can't raise their next fund because the next fund can't be raised till you've invested the last fund. So the structure and incentives just drove them all off a cliff because you're not allowed to sit on uncommitted capital. That's not how it works.
And again, it's easier to syndicate with a group of other venture capital funds at what you say, and I agree, is crazy values, unicorn billion plus dollar values with no revenue, and a model that says I'm going to buy revenue growth by expanding my losses. I've never quite understood that. A lot of people have what I consider lost a key aspect of growing a business, and that's called proof of principle. Just to see if a business works through organic growth, to tweak it and understand the messaging better for potential customers. With unicorns, you just don't see that that's important. It's just, what's the next round? What value? How quick can I get to a multiple billion dollar value? And it's almost crazy. Even go back and look at Amazon. I mean, Amazon lost money, I believe, for 16 to 18 years before it turned a profit. And it didn't turn a profit in its core business. Its cloud-based computing business was the first business that allowed the whole company to announce its first profit. And the billions of dollars. Now, that's a phenomenal success story. So you would argue that model works. Why not do it 100 times? But there's a ton of other examples that didn't work that we can talk about. I mean, to me, it's not something I've ever done. I don't use the word never or ever often, but I've been approached with these unicorn values many, many times. I'm not smart enough to get it, to be honest with you.
So let me go back to the institutional world that you're like an expert in. So when a fund allocator is sitting there looking at, let's say, okay, I'm allocating to real estate private equity and I'm looking at Lubert Adler, Starwood, Carlyle, how do they make that decision?
Analytically, they look at prior track records. I think that's really, when it comes down to it, they all look at your back office and they say, do they have an adequate back office? I'd like to believe that the people doing the due diligence on behalf of the pension fund and the people from the pension funds have done it enough that they have certain flags that come up that they look for. But I think it all comes down to references and how you feel about the principles. A couple of things, like I said earlier, how much of our own capital is invested in our own funds? We tend to have more than the average by far. I'll never forget, probably 20 years ago, a major New York bank came to me to invest in one of their funds. And there were three partners. They used words I never understood. They were just so educated people that they used these big words that I never got. And then at the end of the day, I asked some simple Penn State educated questions like, how much of your own money do you have in the fund? And the answer from the three guys was, we each have $1 million in. I think 99.9% of the people would have ended right there. But I asked, is it your own money or is it friends and family? And by the way, I've found over the years, no one will ever lie to you, but they don't want you to ask certain questions. It was the Wall Street Bank that lent these guys the $1 million on a non-recourse basis to invest in their own fund. So I would conclude from that, and I did conclude from that, that our interests aren't aligned.
Zero. They had zero money invested.
They had zero risk.
Yeah.
Zero risk.
Zero downside. Yeah.
So my point is, are we aligned? I always look for alignment of interests. And if I'm an LP wanting to invest in my fund or 20 other funds, I'm shocked more of that questioning doesn't take place. In other words, I always want to be other than institutions, but with high net worth, the vast majority of the time, I'm the highest amount of individual dollars in any of my own deals. I learned 40 years ago, how can you ever ask somebody to put money in something when you don't have at least as much or more of your own in the same deal? How do you believe it if you don't? Now, not everybody has the money, so they should say up front, relative to my net worth, this is a ton of money for me. These are certain aspects that you really need to dig down on, in my opinion. At the end of the day, the better consultants representing the better institutions, I think they drill down on those points.
So if you could wave a magic wand and change one thing about institutional allocation and how the system works, what do you think it would be?
I'd love someone to after a series of X successes, allow that fund to do something, like I said earlier, about being opportunistic across asset classes on a small amount, and then measure them. And if they're not successful, don't do business with them anymore.
Discretion.
Yeah, just give some discretion. I'll give you an example. I came up with an idea for my corporate lending fund called LBC like 15 years ago. And I went to, it was a tough sale. It took me over a year to sell it, but I went to one of the largest state teachers funds in America. I had a great relationship with them, and it took me a long time, but I convinced them to take the allocation from our corporate debt fund, LBC, out of their bond allocation. So their bond allocation of a $70 billion fund had $30+ billion of low yield, very safe bonds. And I said, you should give $500 million to $1 billion, not a billion to me, but me and two others maybe should split $1 billion and let us get you double yields by taking a little more risk, but we know what we're doing to enhance the returns of this aspect of your pension fund. And it was a unique situation. And to this day, 15 years later, this pension fund still writing $500 million checks every time we have a fund out of their bond allocation. But Ben, we had multiple states that said no. They just couldn't change the mechanism by which they go through their diligence.
Why are these institutions so resistant to change?
Because most of the people that run them aren't sophisticated business people. They're appointed to their jobs by political people, and it's not their money, and they're concerned about public reaction if something doesn't go right. The easy thing to do is what everybody else does, the better fool theory. So taking an issue with someone else's capital that's new and creative is hard. It's very hard to have conviction and want to do that in the best interest of the people you're actually representing, which are school teachers or municipal workers or union people.
Do you find that the institutions, the fact that you sit across so many sectors, you have so much experience, is that a positive to them, or why aren't you more focused?
I think it's probably neutral to negative than it is neutral to positive. I think they don't understand anybody that's been involved with 8 different asset classes just on the institutional side. But it's never held us back because, as you know, I represent the deans of the world as the full-time reps for that asset class with a wealth of experience.
So let me just transition to one of your great passions and deep experiences we touched on earlier. I want to talk about venture capital and real estate. So let's talk about venture capital for a second, because as you said, you're not one who chases the limelight, but you have more experience in venture capital than more than 99% of people in venture capital. You've made, I don't know how many, hundreds of VC investments over 40 some years, right? So you started in VC. Is it right to say 1985 would be the start date?
Right around there, yeah.
So working for Safeguard Scientifics. And then outside Philadelphia, Pete Musser is maybe not as well known, but he's one of the first venture capitalists in the country.
He was my mentor in venture capital. And I was kind of his mentor in real estate. That's what brought us together. He owned a company called the Nichols Company that evolved into a public REIT called Brandywine, which is run here in Philadelphia, New York Stock Exchange. And he came to me needing help to grow that business and teach him real estate because he was always venture. I had my toe in the water in 85, but I really was infatuated with venture and private equity. He really mentored me in that business. It was a good relationship. He passed away 3 years ago, but at the age of 92, but he was just an unbelievable human being.
Yeah, he had unbelievable success. He had QVC. You guys did QVC.
My first investment with him.
This is your first investment, QVC?
I sat on the QVC board for 9 months. That's a great little story. So a guy named Joe Siegel, who died in the last 2 years, on a business plan, came to Pete and said, what do you think of this business plan? Pete liked it. And he took it up to an investment bank called Furman Sells in New York. And on the business plan, they raised $26 million. In a public offering. Had no revenue, no buildings. And 11 months later, a month before he was to go on the air, he ran out of money. That's how we got involved. We put up the needed 15 additional millions of dollars. Safeguard, Comcast, and Fidelity Bank lent part of that 15. And they to this day hold the record of a company that went from zero revenue, QVC, to 100 million in revenue, 11 and a half months. Dell is second. But when we put that $15 million in, Pete and I and another guy by the name of Dolph Pear from Safeguard took over as board. It was important for us to have board representation because that money came from Safeguard, another public company. And we sat alongside Joe, but he paid our loan off. Literally, he opened in November, he paid our loan off in May of the following year. I negotiated 2 million warrants as a kicker for that loan. And those warrants became very valuable. That's the QVC. And then I did a company called Sanchez Computer, and that went public. So yeah, Pete taught me a lot back in the day there.
And then Novell.
Yep, that preceded me, but that was Pete's first big hit was Novell.
And then at least on paper for a moment, ICG, right, Internet Capital Group, was worth $52
billion. $12 billion higher than General Motors at the time. And I was the first outside investor in that company. I hired Walter Buckley and Kenny Fox, founded ICG. And I was some of the outside money. And you talk about a unicorn. That company, because of the internet craze, was worth more than General Motors. It was bizarre. But it had like a 40-some billion-dollar market cap.
$52 billion.
No, that was Internet Capital. But General Motors wasn't worth $52 billion. It was worth something under General Motors. That was the big write-ups at the time. And that was done through Safeguard. But it went up, and then it just imploded.
Now people have a sense. You're talking about 1985. This is a lot of experience. Well, let's start with Safeguard. So what did you learn from Pete Musser about being a venture capitalist?
I learned a ton. I learned about quality due diligence. You really got to probe into all the information. It can't be a one meeting situation. You really got to get to know him. Pete was amazing that everybody he touched loved him. So it's not like a typical VC entrepreneurial relationship where they're very guarded and you're never really that close to each other. People would die to have Pete Musser. So I learned that. I never did that part of it as well as he did, but he was amazing at that. He never really worried about the last dollar on what valuation. He just wanted the deal. We differed on that on multiple occasions. I feel you make money when you buy something, not when you sell it. So you really want to try to be at a value that's an advantage to competition. We differed on that. And then once he shook hands and did a deal with somebody, he was there to help them realize their growth and success. And he did that really well. So I learned an awful lot about him. And I took a lot of the things away, and it's helped me through my career. And quite honestly, I left a couple of things behind.
So Safeguard was not like a typical venture fund, because didn't they link a lot of their investments on balance sheet? So they're much more aligned with the entrepreneur, and they didn't have a closed-end.
Safeguard, I learned a very important lesson, that a public company that reports quarterly earnings shouldn't be making as the core of their business private equity / venture capital investments. Because most private equity and venture capital investments, you can't recognize quarterly revenue growth and profit growth. It's just very difficult. Safeguard had a couple core operating businesses, Safeguard Business Systems, which they spun off. The one I did for them was a company called CompuCom Systems out of Dallas that I ran for them after I acquired it and put it together. And that was a big generator of cash flow for them. But they had 30 small emerging companies. And as most happens, a lot of them don't materialize. They don't all make it. And that really put a stunt in their stock growth. And they had this rights offering concept that they used to differentiate themselves to other private equity funds, where Pete would take you public, Safeguard would take you public. The first one they did was Novell. And thank God for Pete, it went from a dollar to like $70. But that was the biggest curse for Safeguard, because they all didn't do that. So they take something out at $3 public under the Safeguard umbrella. And then when the growth wasn't there, they dropped back to a dollar or under a dollar. Safeguard had to keep propping it up, but they didn't own 100% of the company. So the concept of Safeguard was, in my opinion, it meant well, but it was a flawed concept. Not for any other reason other than expectation of growth is hard to fulfill in a public company making growth-oriented investments in, frankly, non-profitable, soon-to-be profitable, but not yet profitable companies.
That challenge of short-term expectations with long-term compounding growth is a real challenge. I think what's a challenge for almost any investor we work with, it's hard to delay gratification.
But, you know, I learned from another Safeguard board member who passed away a couple years ago, Bobby Fox, whose son, Ken Fox, was the co-founder of Internet Capital. So Bobby had like 15 non-technology industrial deals, all private. Now, he would own 100% of the companies or 90 that he bought from the entrepreneur. They'd roll over a minority piece, but back to he had to have control. But that's kind of like in my family office. I have no timelines for anything in my family office, venture or private equity. And in net, I have 5, 6, 7, 10 operating businesses. Again, I don't own control by design, but these are growth-oriented businesses that send distributions every quarter or semi-annually to me. And I have the luxury, I'll never forget, about 15 years ago, I bought into a failed lead testing company. Uncle died, the nephew was running it, and the bank was calling the loan. And I knew the president of the bank, and I went in and guaranteed a loan and took over the business with a couple partners. And that business is over quadrupled. It's like 8 times greater than it was when I bought it. It's cash flowing tremendously. It's worth 50 times more than it was for what I paid for it 15 years ago. And I keep that in my portfolio. And if it never gets sold, it never gets sold. Again, the nephew who's running the business owns the most. He owns 40%. His name is Josh. And I say, Josh, the day you want to sell it, just let me know and go sell it. You don't want to sell it, just keep sending us distribution checks. You have that luxury in a family office, is what I'm saying.
Well, also, if your incentive was to get 20% of the upside, 20% carried interest by selling the company, and you didn't get 20% until you sold,
then you're going to sell, right?
You're going to sell.
And by the way, one other negative of a fund is you're crossing all those 20%. If one, you lose money, so it's the net 20%. It's not even on an individual basis, which gives you far more motivation to sell.
Part of the reason I started Fundrise is I feel like a lot of the private equity, private market part of the industry really was created in the early 90s. A lot of the structures people think of as normal and the way most of the big businesses got started in the 90s. And it hasn't changed much since then. And private markets weren't a lot like an institutional asset class in 1990. So it's now like mature and maybe sort of time for some change.
Yeah, I think your idea was brilliant. I think technology and creativity enabled you to do what you did, along with a lot of other positive attributes. But think about the market you serve. These are folks that have been shut out their entire life. If you don't have capital, it doesn't mean you don't understand how capital investing can work. And when you read about the Ira Luberts or the Goldman Sachs of the world investing trillions of dollars, and you read it your whole life and never had a chance to be part of it, that's what you give them. You give them a part, an opportunity to be part of these asset classes that would be very difficult for them to be part of. I think that's a tremendous compliment to that asset group of people. I think it's really great that you can do that. I think folks like that generally would be much more patient for the results than an institution would be because they're serving different masters. You're dealing directly with the one writing the check.
Mm-hmm, the principal.
The principal and a pension fund, they're volunteer workers representing people they've never met, teachers and municipal workers.
Yeah. The fact that we have a direct connection to the investor, we can explain to them what's happening. They can agree or not agree, but it's, they're the decision maker. It's very, very different. People who aren't in the institutional world don't understand how different institutions behave as a result of being intermediaries or agents, not owners. Let me go back to the like 85, 97, you run Radnor Venture Partners, right? Technology leaders 1, 2, and 3. So what was venture like in that period?
Not like today, but a lot of money chasing deals, pressure to put out the capital. Trying to understand because of the internet, tomorrow was another new technology or a new twist on the same technology, doing the same thing, but differently and better. And he really needed to analyze, is it a product or is it really an opportunity to create a marketplace or another business classification? That was the hardest part of the due diligence. And then you had to layer on the capability of the founder to draw a conclusion on whether that man or woman could drive you to the promised land. So it was a very competitive market. Technology was obviously all technology that we looked at. And we had to rely sometimes on third-party technology people for their guidance. For the most part, they were successful, but not greatly successful. And then we had our winners, but we also had our losers too.
I don't know if you know this. We launched a venture initiative. Fundrise has sort of added a new asset class.
Oh, I didn't know that.
It's new. We just started. Some investors are like, how do you diligence technology companies? I'm like, well, we have 125 software engineers at the company.
That's a good way to do it.
I turn around and say, guys, what do you think of this product? They're like, oh, we use it at the company. I'm like, oh, really? Great. Tell me about it.
That's great. Do you initiate the deals or do you partner with others?
Just started. The private venture market's in a disrupted place and the pricing's not yet made sense. We're going slow.
Well, I've actually found the pricing is coming down meaningfully. Every week it's come down.
It's coming down, but a lot of great companies haven't yet had to raise money. So you kind of have to wait till they need to raise money.
And what stage? Are you pre-revenue? Are you seed? Are you A?
No, we're mostly looking at like B, C.
Oh, B, C. Okay. So revenue-generated, growth-oriented stuff.
Hopefully less risk, a little more maturity. But our fund's an evergreen fund. So some of the lessons you are talking about, I must have learned maybe some of them from you, but we structured an evergreen fund because and we don't take a carried interest. We end up being sort of a long-term investor without an incentive to sell. It's a crossover fund too. When the market dislocated last year, we actually bought a lot of busted convertibles and credit because we could cross over. Really, flexibility is key to success. So you go from the late 80s to the 90s, ventures changed a bunch. In some ways it hasn't. So how do you think it's changed for the better? And maybe how do you think it's changed for the worse?
Well, it's more crowded. People today, everybody wants to be you. They all want to be entrepreneurs. So you're seeing a lot more stuff. You have to be able to sift through a lot more, I'll call it opportunity. So it's time consuming. That's one of the negatives, I would say. B, there's far more money chasing deals today than ever in history. That's another major negative. Because at some point, you have to put out capital. We don't have to in my family office, but we want to. So at some point, you have to do an analysis on if you're getting in a little higher, is that okay? But third, I find that the people that are founding companies today, what I'll call the quote-unquote young entrepreneurs, are so much better qualified today. To me, that's the greatest difference in a positive way. I have people coming in to see me all the time, and I'm so impressed with the 20, 30-something-year-old founder entrepreneurs.
God, you team me up with so many different things. There's three separate threads I want to pull on that. Let me just do one of a seed investment you did do. I don't know if there was that much more than a business plan, but it worked out for you. So I was there when you turned $300,000 into $30 million with Vertical Net. I think that was 36 months.
A lot of luck, Ben.
Yes, yes, yes. Well, that's how the game works.
Two St. Joe best friend roommates had this concept. Like anything else, they were running out of money. The father, best friend, was a Safeguard guy who called me. They said, these young guys need help. I bridged the company with the $300,000 and a year and a half later went public. And I was fortunate enough to sell it close to the peak of that deal.
Yeah, I was there. I remember that. That was fascinating.
By the way, I'll make it clear. I didn't overpay or underpay for that company's investment at the time. They were just on the cusp. And I just felt that they would just shift a couple things a little differently. And that's one where the advice actually worked. And then it got noticed. And then they went public and did well. And then they got acquired. As you know, they were taken private after that.
In some ways, they're kind of a classic internet story. They go public, got a $1.6 billion valuation in 1999, goes to $10.89 billion in March 2000. And they only had something like $3.6 million of revenue a quarter. And the public market stopped funding that business model. So they didn't have a way to fund themselves, even if there was a great business. They really got trapped by their own success in a way.
And I was not at the peak, but I was long gone. And that's another comment I think that's important in this business. I don't fall in love with any of my assets, any. So as a contrarian, I'm usually selling when people are buying and buying when people are selling.
Yes. Something I remember, you can decide if you want to have this in the podcast, is I remember you hadn't signed a lockup and Goldman was taking them public and Goldman called you up and said, you got to sign this lockup, Ira.
I had six people call me, including Pete Musser, and asked me to do it and I wouldn't do it. And I never did it.
I remember.
Wasn't the deal.
You said, nope. And that allowed you to sell when everyone else got stuck.
They had lockups.
Yeah, they had lockups.
there was a 12-month lockup on that company, I remember. And the stock's going like this and nobody could sell. And that's how I got out. I had another company. I just did a very similar thing. I won't name the name, but a company went public with a SPAC. And I was one of the original investors. And I refused to sign a lockup. And that company got acquired by the SPAC. And I was able to sell. I was in for like $3 and I was able to sell at like $11.83. Today, the stock's $2 because the SPAC world went to hell. And again, it goes back to, I never kick a profit in the ass and I don't fall in love with my assets. And these are just two attributes. And again, I'm not saying they're right. I'm just saying that's how I built my business. And the vertical net examples are ones that I reflect back on and say, I'm glad I did it that way. And they make up for all the mistakes I made, those kind of deals.
When I worked for you, I saw it in practice because I think of you as very contrasted to the West Coast Silicon Valley venture fund. Because two things I saw you do, one is you have price discipline, and two, you really worry about the downside. When you have due diligence companies, you ask me, what kind of assets do they have? What kind of IP do they have? If this goes bad, can we sell that? Can we get our money back, get our investors' money back?
Yep. Still to this day, I always try to take a lean position on intellectual properties, patents, anything I can to protect some or all of my downside. And I contend to you that the difference between a family office like mine and a venture capital fund, they might have one big hit, two good winners, and seven blowouts. If you can lose no money, which is impossible, but if you can restrict the amount of blowouts you have in a diversified fund, your performance can be amazing. And I've practiced that and gotten better at it, as I would hope I'd expect to do it over the years.
Yeah. And I mean, I feel like I started with you, but I watch very few investors want to do that work. Selling assets afterwards, when usually when a company goes bad, venture fund just disappears. They're like, I'm done with this. It's not where I want to put my time.
Yep. But I think that's wrong, to be honest with you.
Well, let me just transition to your last and great love, which is real estate. Maybe your first great love.
Real estate is my first love.
So let's pick up in 1997, right? You leave Safeguard in 1997 to start Lubert Adler.
But Ben, when I was 18 years old or 17 years old, I bought mobile homes in State College, Pennsylvania as a freshman in college and aggregated 39 mobile homes, sold the bad ones, kept the good ones. And when I graduated, I sold it to a local, I think there were 16 of them left that was recurring revenue from the rentals. That sale was a 1031 into my first multifamily, a 32-unit apartment complex in the neighboring town of Lewistown. That's how I really started in real estate.
And you did basically run Brandywine when you were at Safeguard.
Well, I didn't run it. The guy that ran it, by the way, Tony Nichols passed away, but the guy that was there, Jerry Sweeney, who was there, is now the CEO of Brandywine 30 years later. But I kind of advised Pete. In other words, he'd sit in meetings where they'd be talking about building, buying office buildings, and they never did apartments. It's all office at Brandywine. So Pete just wanted to get what I call validation. He'd want me in the meetings, and I kind of gave, and he'd hear me respond to the points they were making. He's a quick learner. He would pick up on that. And in return for that, as I said earlier, he taught me things I needed to learn in the venture capital arena. That was a great partnership for me.
So, you know, I started working for you in 1997. I remember I walked in the first day, I knew nothing, and you handed me a PPM. And I was like, this is the most boring thing I've ever read.
Yeah.
No idea what I was reading at the time. So now Lubert Adler, is it a $10 billion platform?
Yeah, I think it's $11 billion in aggregate today. And it raises two or three funds at a time now over a 3-4 year period. And those funds are average around $750 million apiece.
How I think about this transition is I think of you as you're a great talent scout. Like your innate advantage is you have this ability to spot and cultivate talent that I think is somehow unusual. What do you see in Dean Adler? What made him so special?
Dean is probably the smartest real estate mind I've ever interacted with in my life. But again, go back to Jack's or better. So getting to know Dean over an 8-month period before I decided to leave Safeguard. And by the way, probably for him too, but for me, wanting to make sure that he was honest, ethical, committed, and capable, and that we aligned with each other. What was important to us is how we would treat investors. And did we have a differentiated structure or strategy so that we could build a business together? And I knew day one that Dean was going to be the CEO, quote unquote. And he didn't have, if you recall, an audited track record like I had. So we raised Fund One off of my track record, always with the promise that Dean would become the CEO and the majority owner of Lubert Adler, while I went off and built that platform of what ended up being seven other fund families, which he would own a piece of through MIT. That was the deal. He just couldn't have one leader. And every now and then, Dean comes to me for my opinion on things, but he's the leader and he's a brilliant real estate mind. Everybody loves him. His deal flow is second to none. He's amazing. And he's built an incredible business. He really has. And I mean this as sincerely as I can say it. 100% of the credit for the success of Lubert Adler is due to Dean Adler. Really is. He's attracted a great group of people to work for him, people like yourself who's come through this system, and just how he's been able to change with the times in an ever-evolving differential real estate world. He's always tried to stay ahead of it. It's just been a great partnership. And as I said earlier, through his success comes some of my success.
I mean, I think the first fund was $100 million is what I remember.
Yeah, the first fund I think was 120, then 300, and then went over a billion. And then frankly, through extensive conversations, Dean and I came to the conclusion that a fund should be less than $1 billion for a number of reasons. Focus, getting into the promote earlier, less crossing of assets, being able to fundraise different and tweak your strategy earlier than you would if you have these mega funds. And that was a change we made like in 2012, I think, I'm guessing. And then it's been successful ever since. Just very disciplined $5 to $750 million funds.
What were the handful of seminal inflection points that took you from $120 million to $11
billion? I think just reputation in the marketplace has created so much more opportunity in multiple real estate asset classes, where we embed it all in one fund, and then through conversation and conviction, spun out into multiple funds within real estate asset class. I think that was a very compelling change we made, which has paid off tremendously. And again, we raised too much money on two occasions, to be totally honest with you. We recognized the advantage and disadvantages of doing that, and we've settled into this 5 to 750 category in multiple real estate asset classes. Today, it's three. It's lending, workforce housing, and what you and I would call our opportunity fund. It happens to be called recovery fund, but it's really an opportunity fund today.
So you went through the 2008 great financial crisis, and you have lessons probably from the run-up and from the aftermath. What's the lessons from that? What's your advice?
A, we had too much capital. B, biggest lesson was we were doing build-to-sell resort-oriented projects. In hindsight, we did a lot of things wrong. We did too many of them at the same time, which require a lot of capital because you're building the resort amenities. Two, instead of leveraging them, we had far too much equity. So when the financial crisis hit, we were not anywhere near the same position of working out with our lenders the debt aspect. I give you one, I think, brilliant example. So Jonathan Gray at Blackstone, they did Hilton at the time, but Blackstone was able to use their balance sheet to buy the Hilton debt when that company was failing at real deep discounts. And then years later, that became among their greatest success in real estate when they took it public again. We didn't have that capability because banks were less inclined to work with us because we had so much equity in the deals. That one asset class, which we've never replicated since, we just got out of that business, really was a very expensive lesson learned for us.
We just went through another cycle where there's run-up. Feels like we're at the beginning of this next downturn still.
But far different cycles, although both financially challenged. The 08 financial collapse was a collapse. I mean, the biggest difference has been is the banks in 08 were structurally impaired. And without government bailout or a Berkshire Hathaway bailout to Goldman, I mean, there was massive problems. Today, I argue the banks are in far better financial capability or position than they've ever been. In fact, 2020, the big three banks had their best years ever. So they have tons of cash, but they're very, very hesitant to deploy their capital today. Second, a real run-up of interest rates over the last 6 years. Third, today, the pandemic with supply chain and inflation. Those are the things that you're confronted with today versus the 08. And I argue the fact that the banks are structurally sound, and by the way, unemployment is still very low, that if you have capital and you know how to deploy it today in a sensible way and in a way that you're not undercapitalized, so you have enough runway and enough knowledge of what you're investing in, I think there are tremendous opportunities today out there. You just got to find them.
I'm finding it definitely in credit, mezzanine, sort of rescue capital. There's like a sort of, it reminds me of 2011 or 12 in terms of the yields and the risks, low risk, good yields. What about on the equity side? What do you think are the great opportunities on the equity side?
I think patience will pay off. I think there's even better opportunities today. But if you can find these companies, I think equity buys more today than it ever bought. I think things like participating preferreds that differentiate your round of investing over the prior equity is more acceptable than it's been in years. And that's what we like to do. We like to get our money off the table first through a participation and then own what we own in these situations. And the real due diligence today is how far to cash flow break even. Once you get past the ethics of the people and the quality of their product or service, what you really want to underwrite is what's the runway, how long will it take, and then add a percentage onto that. Try to be, if possible, the last round, or you want to have the next round be a real super growth round where you get a much more attractive value. That's what we're looking for today in our businesses.
Yeah. So as we wind up here, I remember two pieces of advice you gave me. One, when I was leaving Lubert Adler, and you said, you hoped that I would fail early, which was great. And you got your wish. The tech startup I went to work for failed early. And the second piece of advice was, you don't put all your eggs in one basket. You invest and partner across lots of sectors. And those two pieces of advice, I remember them distinctly. What's your advice for me now?
Well, I just say, I'm sure you're doing this, but I can't give you any advice. You've really accomplished so much at your age, probably far more than I accomplished when I was 46 years old. I just think now with success comes responsibility, and you are successful. So now it's about how you can help others. And I'm sure you're doing that. I'm doing it. We just have an obligation to help others through vehicles like this. Just hopefully, if some young folks hear this podcast, like I've never, as you know, I don't give interviews. This is my second podcast ever in my life for two things I love. One is wrestling, which was a major part of my life. They asked me for 10 years. I finally did it last year. And then two, real estate private. It's where I was so fortunate to achieve the level of success. So now if this something like this can resonate in a couple people where they go and change something a little bit because of what they heard and it ends up being successful for them, whether I ever know about it or not, you can't help but feel good about why you want to try doing this. And I remember giving the 1997 commencement address at Penn State. The title to my commencement speech was Fail Early, meaning those who are lucky will fail early and often because you learn so much more from the failures than the successes.
For sure. I mean, you were right. And I took those lessons, definitely all those lessons. I got to learn a lot from that. So, well, this was unbelievable. I really appreciate it. I mean, this was better than I could ever imagine. So thank you.
It's great. Thank you. Stay well.
Thanks so much for joining me. You've been listening to Onward, the Fundrise podcast featuring Ira Lubert, founder of Independence Capital Partners. My name is Ben Miller, CEO of Fundrise. We invite you again to please send your comments and questions to onward@fundrise.com. And if you like what you've heard, rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. And be sure to follow us wherever you listen to podcasts. For more information on Fundrise sponsored investment products, including relevant legal disclaimers, check out our show notes. We'll see you next episode.